think we need to introduce our guest.
Well, thank you for a kind introduction. Right. So I'll try to tell you a story which is going to be some roadmap between various facts, theorems, examples, and I hope it will paint some picture, but of course I'll have to cut some corners, and if you want to see more details, you can go on archive and check out details in this paper. So that's where everything I need will be hiding. So sometimes if you ask me too hard questions, I'll have to refer to that preprint, and again, there you can find more details. So the talk will be about RG flows and certain techniques. So my goal will be to teach you by the end of the hour some new tricks. So that will be pretty cool. So you'll walk out of this room knowing how to do simple new calculations, and it's enjoyable, it's very simple. But those of you who actually watched my talk at the conference will benefit a little bit more. So first I thought maybe I'll tell you the context, how what will happen today may feed or benefit those of you who've seen the talk. So in that talk we discussed three versions of already very powerful techniques and tools. So first version was the Morse theory. And by the way, all of these tools will show up today. I'm not going to emphasize them strongly, but you'll see some connections. So more advanced version or theory is Pickard-Lefschetz theory. And one of the punchlines of the talk at the conference was that in Pickard-Lefschetz theory, the intersection numbers, which we interpret as transserious coefficients, are first of all always symmetric. So in other words, if one cycle beta intersects another cycle alpha, then surely cycle alpha intersects cycle beta. So up to the sign, these are the same. And moreover, n alpha beta are integer numbers. So so that intersection numbers are integers, that, as we usually learn from textbooks. And then the point was of the talk was that sometimes you encounter situations, and these situations are really unavoidable if you want to deal with gauge fields, is that first of all, sometimes the number of Stokes phenomena that you encounter is infinite. So in infinitely many Stokes lines are crossed at the same time. And secondly, that saddle points that you're working with are degenerate. Only one of these things would be bad enough, but what happens in gauge theory is that both of them happen. So in the picture, the way I like to picture it is that you have infinite set of saddle points. Instead of one, each comes in infinite replicas and goes indefinitely. And some of them are nice and so-called Morse saddle points, where around each point you have a nice Gaussian expansion. But some of them are rather singular, so the point itself is a very bad singular point. And again, the situation is unavoidable in gauge theory. And therefore, what happens in this case, that both of these conditions are violated. So first of all, n alpha beta is no longer equal to n beta alpha. And second of all, n alpha beta is no longer integer. And in fact, we had some fun exercises of that talk showing how non-integers come up. So at that point, my point was that in this more advanced situation, or more complicated situation, you need new tools, new techniques, new powerful technology to replace the old ones. And Resurgence was perfectly happy to handle situations like this because it can easily sum infinite progressions into rational numbers and things like that. So Resurgence was our key element back then. But also I mentioned in passing so-called Conley index. and it may sound scary. And I mentioned that that's yet another tool which is useful in situations where hell breaks loose and Picard-Lapschutz theory is not terribly useful. And today, my goal is to explain what this is. If you already know what Conley index is, I'm sorry, this lecture is not going to be as useful to you as it might be. Okay? So the context, however, so this is how it would fit in discussion we had before, but the context for today will be based on the following simple punchline, that renormalization group flows can be viewed as dynamical systems. So this is one key idea of this talk. And I'll try to explore it in the fullest. So what is renormalization group flow? So as a connection, it will try to relate two sides. So it's, you can view this as equation with left-hand side and right-hand side. So it's relating two things. So what about renormalization group flows? This is how we usually describe evolution of the quantum system as scale of the system changes. So typically we get some PDEs, such as derivative of one coupling constant, I'll call it lambda 1, is some function of couplings in the system. And if there are just two of them, say lambda 1, lambda 2, then you'll have one function, we usually call it beta function, describing how lambda 1 evolves. Likewise, for lambda 2, we'll have its own function. So basically what we have is, in the space of coupling constants, if I picture here space of lambdas, we have a vector field at every given point. So if you have on this plane, sort of a, in this example, let's say lambda 1, lambda 2 plane, a point with particular values of dials for your system, this system of equations called RG flow equations tells you how system evolves, where it moves, what it's going to do next with respect to time, which is so-called renormalization group time, log of the scale. So if I'm sitting here, my motion might be, for example, this way. Okay? And then we are usually interested in various properties of such RG flows. We want to compute these beta functions to high order in perturbation theory. And the way it works is that we typically start with fixed points. So I'm going to represent them in this orange bullets, something like this. So the system may have several fixed points. In this lambda plane, some of them might be repelling. So our G flow goes out of this point, then we call corresponding directions relevant. So to some of them, it comes in. So you start evolution, you come in here, but you may go out on other directions. Something like this. Then you may connect it in a diagram of this sort. And so on. So what I just showed you is...
You assume you have heteroclinic connections.
No, no, no. I'm not this. So let's not use language from dynamical systems yet. I'm just doing basic introduction. That's a fantastic comment, but it's way above everybody's head. So let's come back to it a little later. Right, so in fact, my goal is to introduce you a little bit into the jargon of heteroclinic connections and bifurcations. So my goal is to explain what that is. So this picture is actual RG flow, so it takes place in a physical system, in fact, in many systems. For example, you can find it in Cordy's book on ON model in three dimensions. So that's a very simple physical system where there is one fixed point, which is Gaussian, free non-interacting boring point. There is so-called Wilson-Fisher or Heisenberg fixed point. There is a fixed point with Ising symmetry and cubic symmetry. So I'm going to label these points G, H, I, C, if I ever come back to this example. And the way our textbooks, including that Cardi book, are usually written is that we start at a fixed point. We have some perturbative technique to write expansion of these functions to first, second, third order in alphas or lambdas, sorry, assuming they're small or just expanding around a given point. And usually the problem is that in any interesting physical system, including ON model, unfortunately, which is a prototype for any kind of free normalization, we cannot do this expansion beyond five orders or so. And five orders is really hard. So we hold a very advanced conferences and workshops on how to develop these perturbative techniques, ideally to all orders, but it's just hard. So unless your system is solvable in certain sense using either supersymmetry or topological symmetry or something like that, it's actually hard in physical interesting systems to come up with this expansion, which is all order. Like ON model, actual QCD, various other gauge theories in 2, 3, 4 dimensions. And this is where I ask my question, okay, so what can we do? Because ideally, our wish list is completely different from what we can do. Our wish list is much more ambitious. We want to start with a given fixed point, such as, say, this one, and being able to predict in a very concrete computable way where the system will end up if I kick it rolling in a given direction. So in other words, physicists would say that if I start my RG flow from a given theory, I want to know in a computable, predictable way where it ends up, even if I don't go infinitesimal distance away, if I go finite and large distance away from the original point. How to do this?
Normally you get to somehow, right? In many cases, right?
Yes, exactly. So question is how to predict where we end up and so on.
Depends on the profile beta or betas. You see, these equations are like honey flow. You have a profile, mountains and valleys and ridges, and then from one point you let honey flow, and it has infinitely positive, so it's only the first derivative. And then, in order to determine where it's up to, you need to know all, you know, turns of the valleys and ridges and so on.
So I'll try to advocate for a new way of thinking about RG flow, in which we'll be able to make a little bit of progress and hopefully a lot of progress in addressing strong coupling questions. So the goal, the motivation for this is to learn how to advance the flows to all orders. And that's already kind of analogy with resurgence, where we want to understand all order expansion of something. And I want to point out that this is where dynamical systems appears for the first time, where I want to draw this analogy, that if you open a textbook on dynamical systems, first of all, definition of dynamical system is already perfectly fitting to this picture. It basically is a space with a vector field at every point, which determines where you go by this type of equations. So you can already view this as a dynamical system. There is no big caveats, this is perfectly fitting the definition. Question is it an accident? Is it useful? What can we learn from it?
Okay, so, but you started, you know, the very notion that beta function is there reflects that original theory had this, you know, this scale dependence, or they say, short distance, and it's, the notion of normalization point comes from the fact that you have, say, divergence in original systems, right? And here it doesn't matter.
Yes, here it doesn't matter. In fact, I want to liberate myself from even path integrals, because in recent years we learn more and more about so-called non-Lagrangian theories, where you can still talk about RG flows into them and out of them, but you cannot formulate the flow in terms of path integral and divergent Feynman diagrams. So I want to, in approaching this question, have the following critical look at this motivation. Say, I want to take what works best, keep this, and try to replace what doesn't quite work, namely this Feynman diagrams up to 100 order loop expansion, and replace them with something else. So again, what works best is behavior or our understanding of RG flows in the neighborhood of fixed points. So that I definitely want to keep. And then if I look at the textbook on dynamical systems, I realize that, hey, this is exactly the kind of questions that are addressed in those textbooks, because they want to know topology of the flow, structure of the flow, how it changes, by focusing mostly on information about fixed points. And this fixed points is exactly what we have most control in quantum field theory, so it sounds like perfect fit, not just a superficial interpretation of this picture as some sort of dynamical system. So therefore, I want to take it more seriously and explore these connections. In fact, the reason I got into this subject is precisely from those kinds of questions, where I was learning about resurgence, and I'm still learning. And it turns out that resurgence is not as shy in terms of connections to dynamical systems as quantum field theory is. So, if you try to look for papers on QFT and dynamical systems, their interface, you'll probably won't find too much. So this connection is what we're going to explore today, and it's rather shy. But this connection between dynamical systems and resurgence is not shy at all. In fact, two subjects often borrow language one from another. So I'll try to do a little bit of this during this talk. And
assume that somebody comes and gives you the exact expressions for beta 1 and beta 2. Are you happy with this, or you still want something else?
I always want something else, if you give me these expressions and some systems I'm going to mention in a moment, I'll be extremely happy. But I'll try, without such knowledge, unfortunately, I'll try to ask or answer questions circumventing the exact precise knowledge of
people. Okay.
So therefore, to finish up this motivating part, there is this kind of triangle and connection between various regions. So if you're already exploring a relation of resurgence to QFT and applying resurgent techniques to QFT, it sounds to me just as reasonable to try to apply some techniques from dynamical systems to QFT as well. And that's, again, going to be the partial goal of my talk. Again, I don't want to stay superficial. This was just a motivation. So my goal is to ask a very critical point, a question. What do we learn? So suppose we go and explore this a little bit, this connection, sorry, this one. So what is there for me? What does it buy for me as a quantum field theorist? If you're a mathematician, you may already be quite excited that now there is yet another application of dynamical systems, but I'm a physicist, so to me it's important to know what does it buy. In other words, I always like this question, can it do something better than previous techniques could not? Or give alternative view. So first of all, it will offer us in quantum field theory some new techniques. And these techniques include Conley index theory, which I promise to explain today, at least show how it works in practice in simple examples. Bifurcation theory, which unfortunately for lack of time I'm not going to explain today in great detail, though I'll show you some applications and it will show up passively. And connection of, or in how this talk to resurgence. And again, mostly because in dynamical systems, resurgence is used much more actively than in quantum field theory, and that actually could be a good lesson in its own right. And now, aside from techniques are basically your tool bag, something you can take away and apply not only in a given QFT problem, maybe in some other areas. There are concrete applications, concrete meaning to very specific systems or questions. So that's another outcome of this point of view. And just as an appetizer, I want to suggest one particular application or scenario for which details you can find in this paper. So it has to do with transition of physical theories such as QCD, QED in 3-4 dimensions and very strongly interacting systems at the lower end of the so-called conformal window. So I'm obsessed with finding precise values where these conformal windows end. That's a big challenging question. I don't quite know how to answer it, but applying some of these techniques, you can actually learn something very concrete and specific. You can make a prediction based on this analysis that there is an operator in your theory that crosses through marginality, meaning its conformal dimension, crosses value of D, where D is dimensionality of your system, and this goes either linearly with parameter, I'll call the parameter N, and it may represent number of flavors in your system or something else, or quadratically. Oh, sorry, there's a square root. So these are two simple types of behavior, and again, I'm showing a very basic example of an application, but even here there is an interesting surprise. So in other words, what I'm saying is that...
What's the difference between delta and D?
So I'm looking at, given operator, so... So delta is, I mean, that's a good question. D is a dimension of a space-time of a theory. For example, if we talk about 3D ON model, so that's going to be 3. And delta is conformal or scaling dimension of operator in a theory that happens to be very near D. In other words, it's crossing through marginality. When this happens, when this changes sign, we say that it goes from relevant to irrelevant or vice versa. So claim is that in near... lower end of conformal windows, and I give you several examples of this system, we'll see either this or this type of behavior. So this basically means that you have some linear dependence, something like this. So if this is value n critical, and this is parameter n, in dynamical systems, it would be called control parameter, some dial that we're allowed to change. Then delta, which I'm trying to picture here, goes through threshold where it's equal to D in either linear way or in this square root type manner. And the way it does it is either this. So again, this is critical. And that's a very concrete, explicit prediction of dependence in different systems. And here is a quick chart of which one is realized in each system. So of interest are, say, 3D ON model, which I already mentioned before. And in 3D ON model, what happens is that this type of behavior is realized and this is not. And again, you can quickly apply this bifurcation theory analysis to confirm that this is what should happen. And in fact, if you look at most papers, they don't explicitly sometimes postulate or state this result, but that's not terribly surprising. So they would actually agree with that. So that's fine.
So, what in this case, what is the operator to be considered for the scale of dimension?
So in the ON model, this is one of the phi to the 4 operators in the UV theory, but there are several versions of them. So depending, you take phi squared squared or phi to the 4, and one particular combination does this job.
Okay. Are you saying these are the only two behaviors possible?
No, of course not. I'm saying that I'm giving you a summary, and again, this is appetizer. So what bifurcation theory does, it actually classifies what can happen and gives you criteria for what should happen. So I'm giving you a summary of this analysis in the simplest possible situation.
But when you're starting with ON model, you're implying that it is, kind of minimalizable form of the model,
Yes, I'm assuming that it's renormalizable or, say, described by the action quadratic usual kinetic term plus various phi to the 4 terms and trying to understand. In this case, the space of couplings is not huge. In fact, you can mostly focus on just two couplings. But again, my goal is to A, test it in these cases, and then apply to more interesting systems where the space of couplings will be 15-dimensional. And then it's, of course, very hard to visualize where the critical points are, and that's where these techniques will be most useful. But let me show you some interesting surprises even here. So if you continue this to, say, 5D RAN model as your next example, then applying same type of analysis, you don't have to do very detailed calculations. And unfortunately or fortunately, this has never been done by other techniques in the literature, so this is completely new prediction. You would say that this type of behavior happens and not that one. So finally, if and in those cases, n, this control parameter with respect to which change happens, is literally the n of ON model. So then there are various gauge type theories, such as three-dimensional QED and QCD. So here, it's interesting because there is quite a bit of literature on lower end of conformal window in QED or QCD in three dimensions. And most of the proposed scenarios sit here. So they advocate for this type of behavior. But if you look at the problem through the looking glass of this dynamical system and use those techniques, you actually say that this does not happen. So you have to go against predictions. And the conclusion is here. Again, I'm just summarizing.
It is number of matter field or what?
Right. In this case, thank you. That's a very good question. Indeed, N becomes number of flavors, what we normally call NF. So that's a very concrete prediction. In fact, I'm somewhat willing to put reputation on the line and go even against the majority of the literature. So then you can try to apply this to four-dimensional QCD and other problems. And I have to say that this is just an appetizer, of course. I'm hoping that there are many more applications, even to other subjects discussed in this program, even this week or previous weeks. So I'll be very open to explore new applications of the techniques. So I wanted to show you an outcome of concrete application. And again, today I'll try to discuss some of the techniques. Any further questions?
Can you explain on the operator that you have? I couldn't catch what you said.
So here, the concrete prediction, and this is kind of in line with many ways of trying to understand lower end of conformal window, is that there is a certain operator in the theory, here, here, and here, such that its conformal scaling dimension is very close to dimension of space-time. This is very important. That's the phenomenon of where you have so-called marginality crossing, going from relevant to irrelevant or vice versa. And the precise prediction is for the right-hand side, namely, how does this value change with parameters of the system? So either it goes linearly or the square root, and this was indeed a very valid question. There are many other types of behavior which I suspect can be found by trying to match what kind of dynamical system our particular physical system or QFT represents. So I haven't explored it. So this is, again, just a simple application. And I wanted to show you this application just to kind of illustrate that it's not completely vacuous, even though we focus on techniques for the rest of this talk, that there is something concrete can be learned. And again, I hope that there is even more than that can be learned by exploring various other applications. So let's look at another conclusion from applying this sort of technology to RG flow would be the following. Imagine that you have the following system. Again, I'll just illustrate it on a two-dimensional space of couplings where there are two parameters that can run. And the structure will be roughly as follows. So imagine that you have this sort of flow diagram. It could be just given to you from some knowledge of computing or from knowing exact betas all over this space of lambda. Suppose we had that. So then, to a trained eye of a person in dynamical systems, it would ring a bell or raise a red flag. There is something funny about the system. So this is how the flows go. Most of the time, I'm not going to clutter the diagram by presenting all of the lines. In fact, I'll try to keep it as minimal as possible so we can see the forest for the trees. But if you really want to fill in the details, that's how it goes. And what's funny is the following, that here you have one direction which corresponds to relevant deformation of the theory, which is flow out. So if you introduce the following quantity mu that counts number of relevant operators in your conformal fixed point, then for this fellow, mu is equal to 1 because you have 1 going out and 1 coming in. For this one, you also have mu equals 1 because you have 1 coming in and 1 going out. And for this one, you have mu equals 0 because everything comes in and nothing comes out. So this is a very strange situation, or rather delicate situation, that any of the textbooks on dynamical systems would tell you. Namely, they would say that if you encounter such a situation, you should look in your problem for a parameter. Let's call it M, just again for that same name, or maybe you want to think about it as NF. And this type of behavior, so this whole picture, should happen at a very particular value of NF, NF critical, such that you're just on the edge of the transition. So again, I'm not explaining how it comes about from those textbooks, but basically what's good about this theory is that it's a mathematical machinery which tells you that if you encounter this, then you're at a phase transition. And if you perturb your value of n or nf just a little bit, you'll find the following two scenarios. Either with this 3 points, the profile of the flow does something like this, or, so if this is above NF critical, or if you're below the value of NF critical, the corresponding profile will be something like this. And as you can see in drawing these two pictures, which are small perturbations or deformation of this original one, they don't change much of the asymptotics. So at everywhere far, if I surround my system by big sphere, I see that asymptotically or away from this point, everything is the same. But what happened is that connectivity of the flow diagram and topology of the RG flow has changed. So what this technique can tell you is how exactly these changes happen. So those guys classified all of this. And moreover, they tell you that if you know behavior of your system or connectivity of your flows on one side, for example, for very large NF, then you can actually determine what happens at lower values of NF if you know the type of the transition, or vice versa. If you have two corner points, this one and this one, for very small NF and very large NF, you can actually determine what kind of transition happens in the middle. So this is basically a very nice, simple version of what in quantum field theory people may know as well crossing type formula. So this subject of dynamical system is full of that discussion in a very concrete, simple terms, which uses so-called connection matrices, which basically encode which point is connected to which one. So again, I'm more summarizing here the conclusion that if you encounter this situation, then you should expect this type of behavior. Yeah.
The mu's in the picture on the right, those are not all equal, so, or are they? The reason there was a transition was on your picture on the left, the mu's weren't all equal.
Right, so the reason, that's a very good question. I'll come back to it in a second. Now, in fact, I was planning to explain exactly that. So why, what's the physics point here?
No, my question was, it looks like the mu's are still not equal in this picture, so why is it there for the transition?
No. I mean, here, what happens is that mu didn't change. The points themselves didn't change. So we have mu equals 0, mu equals 1, mu equals 1, mu equals 1, mu equals 1, mu equals 0. So what the difference between this situation and this is that for every pair of theories which are related by flow lines, here, in this type of diagrams here and here, you have mu uv is strictly greater than mu infrared. And I'll explain why that's important. Whereas here there is something funny going on. You have a particular flow where index mu of one of the theories in the infrared and uv are exactly identical, and that's rather peculiar. I'm going to comment on this. So that's the difference. But Martin, you also
have a question. I don't see that. I mean, you say the first diagram is very very peculiar, but it looks familiar in the sense that you have a UV fixed point, a couple of saddle points, and maybe there's an infrared fixed point.
Right. But what I'm saying is that if you encounter this in your system, you're actually sitting on a phase transition. So that's the upshot of bifurcation theory. If you think about it physically, and very few people tried, you may kind of suspect that, but what this offers you is a mathematical apparatus to handle these situations. So now I can say this with great level of confidence, and in fact tell you a lot about phase transition if I say, you know, small enough and large enough behavior. So that's what it's good for. And again, why this is peculiar, why this happens. So imagine that in our RG flows, we have a strong form of the C theorem. So what we call a C theorem in physics is a statement translated to language of dynamical systems that there is a Lyapunov function which is strictly decreasing along the gradient flow, and flow is actually gradient flow. So in that situation, and in clean versions of that statement, what has to happen is that this index mu, which is like a Morse index, should actually decrease. And physically, this makes a lot of sense. If you're trying to go along the flow, you're integrating fields out. So therefore, if you kick your system along some relevant direction, you lose a relevant direction. So when you arrive to the infrared fixed point, you have at least one less relevant operators in your system because you just lost one. And for this to happen, for this phenomenon to happen, what must be the case is that you lose some relevant operators, but they also come back to you through some interesting mechanism, and this rarely happens. In fact, there are very few physical systems where this happens for very well understood isolated RG flows between isolated fixed points. So this kind of condition is a signal that strong, I mean, if you follow it, you actually basically learn that if you encounter such situations, strong form of the C theorem cannot hold, and your flow is not really a gradient flow, something breaks down. In the language of Morse theory, Morse transversality breaks down and other things.
But Also, in terms of flows, it looks very unstable, right?
So exactly. Yes. Yeah. So that's precisely the point, and the idea of the theory is to formalize it and go away from the simple example and have tools how to detect it. So one simple way to detect it is a violation of this inequality. So that's a simple characteristic that, again, you assign just to individual fixed points, which is relatively easy with QFT tools, and you immediately learn something about global topology of the flow. That's a simple example of what we had.
What kind of violation? It is almost definition, right? You call it UV when it's larger than
the IR,
right?
You can imagine, like Marty said, that there is, first, that if you look at it, it looks like nothing is wrong. That's a normal flow. So it could be UV, IR, and so on. Okay, so let's try to ask ourselves. Suppose, so here I kind of reversed the situation. I already started with a concrete diagram of the flow right at the transition, but in physics, we actually want to answer a different question. We want to approach the system, say, from large enough, where we have no idea what happens at lower values, so we're actually discussing this part of the diagram and have little access here, or sometimes we may be in a lucky situation where we have kind of two boundary conditions and want to say what's in between. And that's actually where these techniques are most helpful. So not when you already know everything, but when you try to constrain it from two sides. Fill in the blanks. I'll use the slogan several times during the talk, and if anything, you can take out from this talk that what this theory is good for, these techniques, they're a good mathematical way of filling in the blanks. So if you know some boundary behavior at extreme values of parameters, such as nF, for large nF and small nF, or for different regimes in coupling space, it will fill in the blanks for you in a mathematically rigorous way. So that's the cool thing about it. And I would say that's the main outcome. So how do we detect it? Suppose we didn't know the whole picture and only have half of it. Can we guess what should happen there? We can look at the behavior of this Lyapunov function, C function, if there is any way we can access it. So that's one way. I'm not saying that's the only way. And in such situation, what it would be doing, if you have this sort of transition between two phases of your theory, at value nF critical, the C function in one infrared point on this flow will behave like this. So this will be IR1. For second guide, it will be something like this, IR2. And they'll basically cross. Okay, so there are two branches of the C function. And what you should look for, if you are starting from large values of nF and you have computation only of this fellow, you should ask for non-analyticity if you're able to analytically continue your C function as a function of nF, some parameter, to a finite region.
Sorry, and now you say C function here, so you mean Lyapunov function, like these are local Lyapunov functions around the fixed points that we have, or what do you exactly mean by Lyapunov function in this picture?
Good question. So there are actually, that's a great question and great subject. There are three forms of the C function theorems or theories that you can find in physics literature. One is where this function is assigned only to critical points. And then the statement is that value of such Lyapunov function at this critical point should be less, or this one should be less than this one. So, but it assigns it only to critical points. Second one assigns it to the entire space of lambda, so that's actually what I'm assuming here. And this more advanced version says that it's decreasing along the flow. And third version, which is the strongest one, and that's the one which is still open, is whether the flow is actually gradient flow with respect to that Lyapunov function. Not only that it's decreasing, whether we can write our flow equations, lambda dot equals gradient of C, of lambda. So it's actually defined everywhere in the field space. Okay, so where is the eraser? Thank you. So one concrete realization, again, just as an example of how you would detect this sort of behavior, is in three dimensions, where the corresponding C function, for historical reasons, is usually called F. Actually, we don't have a good understanding of 3D C function. That's why I'm proposing this, since it's controversial or not entirely clear what the end result is going to be. But one way to determine it is, in the case of supersymmetric theories, or even more generally, by the following procedure called F maximization. So F is basically a free energy of the system, or otherwise log of absolute value of the partition function computed on a three-dimensional sphere. And in order to find the precise value of this C function at a given critical point, what you're instructed to do is to write an ansatz as a function of all possible values of scaling dimensions delta, or equivalently R charges, and find a local or global maximum such as this one in this figure here. Okay. So to realize this type of phase transition, this scenario here, we already asked ourselves, okay, so what C function could be doing? So let's ask, from the viewpoint of this F maximization, what could be happening, and describing this type of transition called heteroclinic bifurcation, which was already offered before as a name for the process. So what must happen is that two panels, here and here, or equivalently these two branches, values of C function at one fixed point and another fixed point, have to come from the following situations, where in one case, this F maximization gives this point as a global maximum. And then you tune your parameters, and what happens is that these humps exchange their top values, and this fellow becomes now the maximum, and indeed you go from one branch to another. That's how they cross. So F is again minus log of Z. And this is as a function of delta, but these two panels are supposed to be for NF less than NF critical or some other control parameter, and NF greater than NF critical or some other control parameter, whichever you use in the system. In other words, when the real part of free energy or C function happen to be equal, then for these two values of delta 1 and delta 2, then you experience this jump from one branch to another. That's how you could see this phenomenon from the C function point of view. And now we can actually start using this more seriously, because C function is something that we actually do study. We often do compute it in the range of parameters where NF is large. So we do have access to this information. So now, since I run this process in reverse, I know what to look for. I have to look for non-analyticity of the C function as I try to continue it from, say, large NF into smaller NF, and look out for any kind of non-analytic behavior. So here it would be transitioned to a different branch, but there could be other types of behavior represented by Stokes phenomena, which indicate different types of phase transitions or different bifurcations in the language of dynamical systems. So I'm not going to bore you with three-dimensional F maximization too far. I'll just make one more step and let you carry out the rest of the calculation. And then we'll switch to our final topic. It has very little, I mean, it has many nice properties and many confusing properties. So nice property is that in supersymmetric theories, it's easily computable, and people have studied it in great detail. I'll give you an example. But it has many confusing properties at the same time, because as a candidate for the C function in three dimensions, we don't actually know if it's the right candidate, what's the precise statement. This is a moving target. That's developing story. So, okay, so what we have to watch out for from taking this as a lesson, if you're studying QFT and computing various quantities, the lesson is that we take our control parameters, say number of flavors, and look for non-analytic behavior. If we're trying to extend our answers very far from perturbative regime where things are under good control. So in the case of supersymmetric theories, which is the only case I'm going to illustrate for you today, and where this can be done in more detail, let's look at supersymmetric version of QCD, SQCD with SU2 gauge group, and again, NF is going to be number of flavors. By localization techniques and work of many people, like Brian over there, we know precisely what the partition function Z is. So it's given by a single integral, single because I decided to specialize to gauge group SU2, so it has one-dimensional Courton. And the answer looks extremely concrete, very much like what you see in matrix models. And you can even interpret this guy as a matrix model where this function L is some form of the logarithm. Again, you can find it in that reference I mentioned with all the details of normalization and so on. But now you can approach it through the eyes of resurgent theorists, and in particular make an expansion for a large value of NF, which is something that we usually have even when we don't have the closed form. So most of the time for interesting physical systems, we actually try to do large NF expansion, and that's how traditional methods usually approach the question. So we have, in this case, something like a power law, then exponential, and some of the perturbative 1 over nf pieces. So you have coefficients an, nf minus minus n. So this is written as nf goes to infinity. And usually in systems where this might be really interesting, or you should kind of keep in mind, we have some access to this expansion, but not necessarily to the full thing. Of course, here in this simple model, I can use advantage of it to immediately say a lot of things about behavior of these perturbative coefficients. For example, we can quickly say that absolute value of this coefficients should go as gamma of n plus delta over some number to the power n. And this delta, the offset, comes precisely from 3/2. That's, again, for people who are familiar with resurgence, for our participants here, this is child's play. That's very obvious. In fact, you can also make a prediction that for absolute value of A, that's a next saddle in this integral form. So for those who are familiar with resurgence, this is exercise in resurgence 101. But from applications into real systems, this is usually where we start, and people try to compute first few coefficients, then determine what's the asymptotic growth or large order behavior of these ANs. And of course, what we know from resurgence theory is that large order behavior will tell you about next saddle, and that in turn can tell you about this behavior, what happens if you hit some non-analyticity if you try to use Borel or summation. So that's what we usually do. And in fact, if you try to follow this, basically what you learn, the punchline, which does not belong to me, it belongs to Michael Berry, is that, so this, I believe, goes to 1989 or something like this, that Stokes' phenomenon that we may encounter in Borel resumming or resurgent analysis of this perturbative series, which again is what physicists usually compute, is nothing but a particular version of bifurcation for the RG flow in the underlying space of couplings. So that's basically the punchline. So what I'm trying to say is that this kind of phase transitions and different phases of the system can be detected if you know even asymptotic behavior of the C function. So there is a trace of this non-analyticity that you can look for. And again, if you're a quantum field theorist, not familiar with resurgence, talk to everybody in the resurgence program and they'll convince you that how this is done. Okay, any other questions?
So often we think of the Stokes phenomenon as taking place as a function of the phase of some coupling constant, to which we often don't attach a physical meaning, that the phase of the coupling is introduced to the temporary device. So here it's connected to a change in the scaling dimensions, or the things going from relevant to irrelevant to the two sides. So that sounds very physical. So that's,
That's very. Well, and what the application Michael Berry had in mind when he talked about this is in the context of topology change of a flow in a dynamical system. And that, of course, is also very physical. And you could ask question even then. So why would he care to call some phase transition in dynamical system a Stokes phenomenon? And I really encourage everyone to take a look at his paper. Okay, so basically what bifurcation theory is, from this point of view, it's a theory of topology changes. So if you like topology changes, you probably want to explore bifurcation theory. And my common theme in this lecture was that if you have system where somehow you know the boundary conditions and you're approaching it from large enough side, or if you have extra data about small enough, you want to know what's in the middle. That's usually exactly what we're missing in physics. That's where usually things are hard and you can approach it from one regime or another. This could be some same kind of philosophy in the field space or in the space of couplings, but that's exactly what dynamical systems and many of the tools that they developed are good for. They're good about filling in the blanks. So if you have some asymptotic regimes which are under Gould control, that's a mathematical theory telling you how or what you should expect in the middle. So therefore, the next and the last topic for today, or illustration of those techniques, is the Conley index theory. And I want to describe it as a tool to fill in the blanks. So that's the picture you should keep in mind. So in particular, if you have some region in the space of couplings lambda, we're always going to be clear about what the region is. So let it be this big blob. Think of it again as a space of two-dimensional couplings where you have the flow. And suppose, very much in the spirit of this discussion, you want to find what's inside by knowing only what happens at the boundary. So suppose at the boundary, somebody told you that, or you determine it from perturbative analysis, that flow looks like this. So can you, just by looking at this, say whether there should be a fixed point, for example, inside?
And it's a circle. It should be some sort of circle.
So again, this is filling in the blanks. So what's the answer?
It means that it would be like
why?
Because it should be inside.
It's a hedgehog.
Well, hedgehog is not a very mathematical statement. If I ask you to draw this in five dimensions, how would you say?
Or what? No, but it is at the circle, it is like a
saddle. or?
But first of all, the question is, how do you know? What's your thinking process?
The input dimensions is Poincaré bending, right?
Exactly. It's Poincaré Lefschetz fixed point formula, and what you compute, and many of you probably did, whether you know this or not, you're trying to ask about winding number.
Yeah.
So that's really what's going on. So, and that's already a first hint that you don't have to know everything that's happening inside, and information on the boundary can give you some information. So what we're going to do next in the remaining 10 minutes, I'll give you a huge upgrade of this statement that will allow you to do more examples. For example,
winding was before coming in this, right?
Huh?
Winding, for example, you can define.
Right, exactly. So for you, Arkady, I have the next challenge, therefore. So suppose you want to determine what happens in this region. Okay? And I'm telling you that your flow does this. Can you easily tell me what's going on? If we should have a fixed point in the interior or not? Anybody has a guess?
In some directions you go in, and in some directions you're...
Yes, so there are three, you go in, three go out, go in, out, and so on. So, yeah. How many?
Is that something like outgoing minus ingoing errors is the number of zeros of a vector field inside or something like this?
Something like this, but not exactly true. So while you're thinking, I solicit interesting guesses. I want to show you where this really is useful. So, and then, but of course, I'm going to illustrate it in a figure like this. But the actual interest in this problem or application is. Let's see. Let's see if it's working. Okay, good. So this is, I pulled for you one of the papers. There are many papers on perturbative RG flows in QCD where people try to include various kinds of operators. So in this case, these are, I believe, psi to the four fermion operators. And they try to compute perturbative beta functions. Again, the goal is, of course, is to produce fairly high order calculations. So the caption of the figure says, this is RG flow running in the vicinity of some points, and it shows only three couplings. So the actual scope of the paper is...
It's not a four-dimensional QCD, right?
It is, it is. It is four-dimensional QCD.
But the four-dimensional operator is...
Yes, it starts life as irrelevant, and they explore what happens to those operators. So where is it? So I'll show you. There are in total five couplings because there are four operators, these guys, four Fermi operators. There is a gauge coupling in addition, so it's a five-dimensional space. And somewhere down the road, I guess, here, they produce for us a hypersurface slice of this five-dimensional space, and they ask to analyze what's the structure of the flow, what it's doing, and go figure what's the connectivities, what's stable, what's unstable. So it's in situations like this, where we cannot easily draw two-dimensional pictures on the blackboard, that this analysis of Conley index is useful. That's where we're going to throw. So the same authors, a bit later, wrote this paper, so maybe I can show you even further. So see, it's a messy figure. If you really try to analyze it, it gets very complicated. You want to know what are the fixed points, how they're connected, are there topology changes in the flow, and that's where things become fairly difficult. So the way to go about it is to ask Mr. Charles Conley. So he had a relatively short life, unfortunately, and he's an expert originally on dynamical systems and many related fields. So he says the following. So first of all, if we want to answer the question, what kind of the structure of the flow is inside the black box that we want to analyze? So this is again that same figure from Cardi's book on flow in ON three-dimensional model. We'll do this, but we have to focus on part of the boundary where the flow is outgoing. Okay, so we'll decorate this part of the boundary where arrow is going out by red, and that's going to be exit set of the flow. Okay, and then from this, he gives you the so-called Conley index. It's going to be cohomology theory, such that it will capture more information and will be good tool in higher dimensions like these 5D flows that I just showed you, a lot more than we can do from counting the winding numbers or who goes in and who goes out. So that's going to be extremely precise, and at first it's surprising that this thing can even exist. So, but if you want to use it as a tool, focus first on the exit set. So draw your domain, focus on part of the domain where it's exiting, and these are the same examples I already showed you. And now we're going to have an equation relating two things. First of all, information about the internal fixed points and how they're connected. In particular, in this case of in this example of flow in ON model, there are four fixed points, and we're going to use pretty much the same thing as we do in Morse theory. We count each one with the corresponding Morse index, which we already had some practice with today. For example, Gaussian fixed point here has two relevant operators. Morse index is two. We have two ways to go down. And correspondingly, what we're going to do in constructing this cohomology group, that's actually what Conley index is, we'll put one-dimensional space, one, for this fixed point in homological degree 2. Okay? Then we're going to do the same for other fixed points. And just as in Morse theory, their Morse index is going to determine cohomological degree, and connectivity will determine differential. So that part is the same as in Morse theory. I'm not going to spend too much time on it. I'll spend more time on how we determine what's going on, that same cohomology group, from information on the boundary. In other words, how to answer this question that Arkady is still thinking about. He didn't give me a proposal yet for how many fixed points should be here. And then 2 minutes, we'll have the answer. And we'll play with similar games in many other examples, in five-dimensional flows or more interesting topologies. So to answer this question, what you do, again, you focus on the exit set, and then you try to collapse everything in red, the entire exit set, to a single region and eventually to a single point. We're going to construct cohomology or homotopy complex, so we don't care about thickness or forms or shapes here, but we care about connectivity and collapsing this red region to just one single point. This is basically a slow motion. And then we're going to do something interesting. We're going to say we perform this process, and as a result, we take cohomology of this space, except that it's a zero-dimensional, zero-degree piece. So, for example, here, so maybe I should turn on the light and do it a little bit more slowly. So, in this example here, what we see is that we have two circles, okay? So, cohomology of this resulting space is the following. It has two copies of Z, each in homological degree 1, because there are two one cycles and two circles in the game. And normally, if we really try to do simplicial homology, we would also add Z in homological degree 0, which would correspond to class of a point or represent the zero forms. But according to Mr. Conley, at least in the version of the theorem that I want to show you, we take this away. So basically, we remove this guy. Or maybe I'll keep it on the board and cross it out in red to emphasize that we decide to drop it. Okay. So then we conclude that in this example, so that's the answer. Therefore, this homology is supposed to be same as homology of the fixed point set inside, including various ways of connectivity. So therefore, we immediately conclude that it should be at least two fixed points of Morse index 1 inside this whole set. So that's the precise answer. That's the answer you can get very quickly, immediately, and as you can see, it's fun to play with these games.
You said precisely, and then you said also more than.
Right.
So
Exactly. So I'll show you. So this is example of this calculation for different values of exit set if you're working with domain which is just a disk. That's the simplest possible option. Here you can easily classify all versions of the exit set. And indeed, for the one we're discussing, which is right here in the bottom, that's the example we just computed. You can easily try to fill in the blanks. But that's what we did. And one way is to propose this sort of flow. Indeed, it has two fixed points. That's fairly generic. And both are of Morse index 1, because there are directions which flow in and flow out. And this is true for both of them. So Morse index is 1. But this is not unique. This is constrained like typical index or cohomology. It says what has to be there, but there can be more things that cancel upon connectivity. And this is an example where you have one fixed point of Morse index 2 and three fixed points of Morse index 1, and one pair can be canceled. Again, it's fairly generic, and that's another option. So what this does for you, it doesn't capture everything. It's not panacea, but it does much better than when we have five-dimensional flows and we're just guessing it from the winding number. So that's a very useful information. So I don't want to abuse much the time allowed to me, but I guess you can try to play in your head with some other examples. For instance, imagine that your exit set is all of the boundary of our disk domain. Then by collapsing the boundary, because now all of it is exit set, we get a two-sphere. So we follow the same exercise. We take cohomology of a two-sphere. It has two pieces in degree 0 and 2. We throw away the 0-degree piece. We get statement that we should have at least one Morse point of Morse index 2, things like that. This game, again, becomes really fun if you have this five-dimensional type of flow as in QCD or in other subjects. So I'll stop here. I have no idea. I know that there is a group working precisely on this question. That's a very good, interesting question. I haven't looked into this. I did look a little bit at Vinitzano limit, where control parameter will be the ratio of an F and an C.
That's what I have in mind.
Oh, I see. If it's Vinitzano limit, then indeed you can, even from large N, try to analyze what happens if you dial that guy and from information that we have about the beta functions. And there seems to be an interesting transition, which, as far as I know, has not been noticed before, at some particular value of that x star, where indeed, according to this theory, topology should change. But how it changes, what it implies for physics, I didn't really look into. So
are you saying you expect within the asymptotically free regime, from naive consideration, one place where...
No, that's within conformal regime. So in
all within conformal
regime. So it's
some second point inside the conformal regime.
Yeah. So if you apply this to conformal window, then I don't think it's the lower end, because numerically it's way above what we expect for lower end of conformal window. Although I don't know, somewhere there between Banks-Zaks limit, 11 halves, and the lower end, it appears that there is a topology change according to connectivity of this, just by taking Vinitzano limit beta functions, feeding them here with this large space of couplings, and Conley index jumps, or it predicts a jump. So that's something interesting. Again, I was meant to look in details. I mean, that particular statement is in the paper, but physical implications and what it means, I don't know.
So what type of criteria you should have to, for this life on a global life on a function to actually be like something like a Morse board functional? So like this term is actually a version.
You need quite a bit, and that's why I think it's a standing conjecture whether it applies in sort of classes of physical systems, or should be more ubiquitous. So if you need quite a bit. You need, for example, a positive definite metric in the space of couplings, in the space of parameters for this statement even to make sense. In other words, to write a gradient term. And again, then there are lots of implications, like the one I mentioned to you regarding the new index decreasing and so on. So I don't think, for example, I was thinking maybe there is a simple way to prove this new theorem, and that would essentially rule out confirm a strong form of the C theorem. I don't think that's easy, or at least I didn't succeed. But there are stringent constraints. So yeah, strong version of this Lyapunov flow is very strong.
So from the dynamical systems point of view, is there situations where you need more than one control parameter?
Yeah, there are plenty, in fact.
Is there something to tell you how many you need?
Well, I think typical dynamical system is classified by its basic data, namely what's the dimension of your space of couplings, where you have the flow, dimensionality of the flow itself, and the control parameters, how many you have. Depending on that, there is a classification of, for example, answer to Alyosha's question, what can happen? They classify all possible scenarios for transitions, these bifurcations. Sometimes if you don't have information about how many control parameters you have, but you want to analyze a certain phase transition, they tell you how finely tuned it should be. In other words, what's the codimension in the space of parameters for that particular transition should be. That's also very useful information, because it basically is quantitative putting a finger on naturalness in physics. So there is this criterion which we speculate of. I mean, it's a rough criterion saying that some generic thing should happen, and this basically makes the notion of generic precise. It says what's the codimension, what's the degree of fine-tuning in each particular case you need to have.
So in dynamical systems literature, do you assume the control parameters are continuous or completely discrete?
Both, and as well as lambdas, these are called discrete versus continuous dynamical systems. There are textbooks on each one is a respective chapter in graduate school. So, Mithat had a question.
You showed that there is this nice Stokes phenomenon, and you described it in terms of this flow, and it's, you said it's associated with the phase transition. And presumably, of course, these equations are coming from a field theory, your very first discussion here. So, and presumably there should be a dramatic change in this infinite dimensional field space as well with this phase transition, I would think. So, do you have any guess what's going on there?
Well, in the case of three-dimensional super QCD, actually, the most interesting things would be happening when you have this global bifurcation with the two humps exchanging the height. And I didn't investigate it in detail, though it shouldn't be difficult to find examples of such systems. And then ask, indeed, what is the physics of the transition? So from this Stokes phenomenon of bifurcation analysis, we know that there is something dramatic happening. So question would be, what's the physics of it? It would make ramifications for behavior of scaling dimensions, like I showed, but probably a lot more. So, and again, it would be nice to perhaps in the future when developing this, just make a dictionary between different types of bifurcations in dynamical systems and different types of phases or transitions in the physical theories. This has not been done. So that's part of, I believe, what needs to be done for your answering your question in full.
So naive question, why didn't you need to mention limit cycles or strange attractors?
These are excellent questions. Now, once you have the bridge, I wanted to walk before I can run. I wanted to, first of all, make it useful for QFT rather than just a curiosity or analogy. Now you're asking really a cool question, which is trying to walk this bridge between dynamical systems and QFT both ways. Indeed, in dynamical systems, fixed points are not just boring saddles that I showed you. The most interesting things are all kinds. I mean, there is classification of phase transitions, that's the bifurcation theory, but then there is also classification of fixed points or fixed sets. And they may exhibit all kinds of births and deaths and interesting phenomena. For example, strange attractors or various limit cycles or all kinds of exotic phenomena. And many of them may or may not appear in physics. I think that's a very cool question, very exciting one. I haven't investigated it, but that's very closely related to Mithat's question. I would phrase it as building the dictionary, basically, trying to take something cool from one subject and ask, what does it mean in the other, and vice versa. So that's example to this, of this question. I have no clue, but it's something interesting.
But you were hypothetically, so a strange attractor is associated to chaotic. Physical system.
Again, for strange attractors, I thought about it quite a bit. I don't know. There are very interesting RG flows, which there is so-called Yefimov system and so on, which may serve as candidates for such things. So maybe it's a little easier for me to answer
limit cycles
and circular flows. Those would be a bit.
Physics is a limit cycle.
So that's a little easier to answer. For limit cycle, that would be exactly the question of strong C theorem and implication for Lyapunov function. So that would be indeed very close to the mainstream of what we're interested in QFT. For strange attractor, that's a little bit further away, so I have little to say about that.
Do you in general know what the condition for chaos is in quantum field theory that?
No, I would love to, but I think that may be a good subject for a whole program at KTP.
So you have two conjectures about in 3D, 3D and QCD. What are the ingredients you used to get there? So for me?
Right, so I gave you indeed the outcome, but not what goes in. So what goes in is the information about the large enough behavior and some rather modest assumptions like how many parameters are activated, so what's the total space of coupling, so we can use this classification of bifurcation theory in a given dimension. And perhaps most importantly, continuity of the flow. So that's, of course, very critical for using any of those theorems. But again, I don't know any physical system where there is RG flow, and then suddenly, in theory space, we have a boundary or a system jumps. So this may or may not exist, but I was assuming that this doesn't happen. To me, this would be quite exotic.
You know, when you're saying dynamical systems, then it kind of goes pretty much beyond, you know, G-flow, right? Because dynamical system, you know, I mean, people discuss. So, for example, you know, when they discuss resonances, separatrices, you know, different kind of motion, you know, bifurcation, you know. So, in this way, so, no, okay, I don't know, take resonance, right? Well, it also could be in, I mean, part of such system, right? You are not discussing this particular example, right? So where you would stop, you see, because analogy with dynamical system could go, okay, car or chaos, for example, as well, right? And, you know, there are a lot of stuff which was worked out in connection with dynamical system, and usually, I don't know, I do not think about this in terms of as
before,
right, usually.
No, in fact, the point, or maybe in some sense the message in the talk would be that we shouldn't be shy and take it more seriously for a number of reasons. I would not stop. I would actually ask very interesting questions about some exotic phenomena. And the reason is, again, even from physics point of view, there are fixed points where we don't have path integrals. So we do need other techniques, and we do believe that there are flows into those fixed points in and out, so we do need sooner or later techniques to talk about it in a mathematical way. So thinking about the theory space, space of couplings, which still makes sense for non-Lagrangian theories, from that perspective, I think that's a very valid language and a very valid question. What about strange attractors?
Yeah,
and in fact, if the beta functions are minimally smooth, then it's just a dynamical system in the usual sense.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, therefore, I think we should be brave and explore.
Certainly, usually when you take this boundary, so if you have a perturbation theory, so you continue in these lambdas, then the number of fixed points will increase, right? So how do you determine this boundary? I mean, where do you put this boundary?
That's a very good question. That's in part why I personally worry a lot of just trying to push the order of Feynman diagrams, the theoretic work, by one extra order, because indeed we don't know, and I don't think, sometimes there are criteria, but it's hard to say when they're applicable, and especially in interesting cases, whether just increasing another order and buying you another degree in lambda really represents the right physics. So that's why I think we need some alternative tools. Instead of just naively trying to push it further and further, try to focus on what we have and know easily, like infinitesimal data around each given point, namely the portray of how many directions go out and which goes in, and that's good enough. Kind of stop there and try to use topology to fill in the blanks.
Yeah.